crew drew up both his legs and kicked Wilkes so hard that he flew into the air. He hit hard but rolled, moving with distressing agility. Crew fought for breath, managed to pull himself to his feet. His throat was partly crushed. He cut off the pain as best he could, concentrating his attention in his crashing heart, willing it to beat strong and steady. He waited, watching for movement in the dust, insisting to himself that he would not die here. After a time, he began to hope that the silence he was listening to was the silence of death. Had he won? He watched a last shaft of sunlight creeping across the part of the floor he could see, sunlight that rendered the wheat dust golden. The smell of this place, the dry, faintly sweet odor of grain, reminded him of home. He closed his eyes and concentrated on getting strong enough to get out of here. Only after some moments did he become aware that there was breathing that had not been there a moment before, and that it was very close. Wilkes hammered him in the face so hard that Crew saw an explosion of lights, immediately followed by a curious sort of darkness. He tried to raise his right arm, but it would not come up. Fingers explored around his neck again, this time with tremendous speed and power. With a shuddering crackle, his windpipe was collapsed. In Cairo now, feral dogs howled, jackals yapped and paced, and the old man in his white soutane and fez crossed his arms over his chest in a gesture that would have been familiar to the pharaohs, and bowed his head toward the Great Pyramid. Closer to the structure, a guard looked up from his charcoal brazier and frowned. He called to his companion. Both turned toward the pyramid. They saw along its vast side a spatter of pure white sparks. Coming as if from the throat of the earth itself, a vibrating hum shivered the two men from within. They ran. Crew was dead. He was still moving, but nothing would enable him to breathe again. Mike watched him, smiling with an artist's gentle amazement at his completed work. Crew's air hunger increased. His thoughts were distant and unreal. The anguish of suffocation made him frantic, made his sphincters release, and he shat and pissed himself and rolled in agony on the floor. Mike positioned himself and kicked Crew so hard that his head, flying back, caused his neck to snap. He looked down at the sprawled body, then pushed at it with his foot to confirm the obvious. He went to the door, opened it, and took two small bottles out of his trousers. One was cracked and oozing. Carefully he collected the thick liquid in the palm of his hand. He poured the dark purple contents of the other bottle onto the floor, making a tiny hill of the crystals. Then he poured the glycerin from his palm over the potassium permanganate. He stepped out through the door and was gone. As he sailed the ancient lays of the earth, Crew felt absolutely nothing. Objectively, he knew that he was dead, but this had lost its importance. In Cairo, the pyramid flickered with blue light. People came out onto the roofs of houses, stopped their cars in the streets, stared at the midnight spectacle. Dogs barked wildly, jackals sang, tourist camels boomed, and horses tossed their scruffy manes. Crew knew he had reached the place of ascension. He felt it as a warmth caressing him. All pain fell away, and all memory of pain. A tourist, who had bribed the guards to let him spend the night in the king's chamber, leaped out of the sarcophagus as it filled with blistering incandescence. The old man on his roof moved round and round in an ecstasy of graceful concentration, dancing a dance that had been handed down across the generations, not among the Arab invaders of Egypt, but in the secret Sufi ways that were drawn from the old religion, the hidden science that had last sent souls across the chasm of space when Akhenaten and Nefertiti had gone home, a light so great that it dimmed the glare of Cairo itself, then filled the air. The very stones of the pyramid glowed as if on fire from the inside. People screamed, dogs howled, the jackals writhed in agony. Then, darkness. All returned to normal. The old man bowed again toward the pyramid. Smiling a toothless smile, he went back down to tend his broken heater. An image formed in Crewe's memory of the scents and lights and caresses of home. He turned his face heavenward, following the golden thread of love more and more swiftly. Soon he saw a gentle rain of stars, and knew that this was the passing void of heaven itself. For a few timeless moments, he traveled the perfect physics that was long ago devised for the journey of souls. Then he saw the wheeling immensity of the galaxy, a crystal conflagration of stars in blue, white, red, yellow, green, large and small, spread across the silence. Below him came the gigantic horizon of a planet, as he sailed out of darkness into the sunlit side. Now he saw broad lands, farms in silver morning. He let the weight of his love draw him downward. Soon he could make out individual farmsteads, their thatched roofs clustered together beneath ancient trees. Then he could see, far away, the white city shimmering on the horizon, and carts in the roads going toward it laden and returning empty. Dropping closer, he could hear the great Oris singing as they passed one another on the road, and their drovers humming the tunes that gentled their raucous dispositions. He came to his own farm, saw it spread below him, its fields rich with bowing wheat. The love he felt was so great that it made him glow, and he heard voices rise below. They could see him coming, a shaft of light dropping down out of the sky. He heard his son's shrill voices, and his wife's cries of alarm and joy. Then he was over the cool room, set partly in the earth, where his return would take place. He dropped down through the roof, which felt like a sort of smoke of straw. Below him now was a body on a stone table. It was his own body, indistinguishable from the one the humans called Crewe. It was naked, this body, lovingly groomed. The next thing he knew, he was looking out of its blinking eyes. The room was lit by flickering candlelight. He inhaled. Perfect air, clear, faintly scented with the odor of his wife. He lay naked on the familiar stone table. His wife, looking tired in her sweated muslin work clothes, gazed down at him. She bent to him then, and kissed him long, and he was home. 29. A flash filled the air, as if a gigantic flashbulb had gone off in the sky. Connor began to count. 1, 2, 3, 4. What the hell?
Shh.
6, 7. A long roar rolled in, full of thuds deeper than thunder. Connor looked from Dan to his mother. The grain elevator just exploded, he said. It had to be that, unless somebody had dropped a very large bomb on Little Wilton, Kentucky. Nothing else in town was big enough. The phone rang. Connor snatched it up. Hey, Paulie, I know. Okay. He pointed out the kitchen window. Caitlin saw a great mushroom of smoke rising in the direction of Wilton. Within a couple of minutes, a horn started honking out front. It's the Warners, Connor yelled. As he stopped at the hall closet to get his jacket, Dan grabbed the video camera. Caitlin did not want to be trapped in a car with the Warners. She went out behind Dan and Connor. We'll take our car, she called. But Connor jumped into the Warners' back seat with Paulie and they were off. She and Dan went into the garage and got in their car. Thank you, he said. I consider that a rescue. What in hell happened in town? And how do we know it's the grain elevator? What if it's terrorists? In Wilton, Kentucky? Anyway, Connor's always right. He stepped on the accelerator, seeking to stay close to the Warner's speeding van. Mike Wilkes was just starting his car when the blast took place. There was a gigantic roar and a flash like a sheet of silver-white filling the whole world. Frantically, he switched on the ignition. The car was already in motion when a large piece of the elevator's tin roof struck it, smashing the windshield and caving in the roof to the point that Mike was lucky even to get the door open. As he crawled out of the ruined car, a segment of conveyor bucket slammed into the snow a foot away. He slid under the car then, and waited while debris rained down. When it finally stopped and Mike came out, he saw that the car was a complete wreck. Worse, he could hear sirens. He had to get away from here. The elevator was burning furiously now, the fire heating his back even from this distance. At least he had accomplished his objective. In a little town like Wilton, a spectacle on this scale would draw everybody who could move, and especially the kids, as he had intended. He loped in the direction of a line of abandoned stores across the street from the elevator and ducked down an alley. As he did so, a small fire engine came up and stopped, its horn blaring, its siren whining. It stopped beside the Volvo. As the siren ground down, firemen jumped out and examined the car. An instant later, they all looked up, directly toward Mike. His tracks, of course, his damned tracks in the snow. He turned and ran, ducking down an alley and out into a disused rail yard. A glance backward told him that the antenna still stood, taped as it was to the tank farthest from the collapsed roof of the elevator. The transmitter would be doing its work now, and would continue until the tank itself disintegrated. He threaded his way across frozen tracks. He could not escape, of course, not slowed by the snow and chased by men who were not injured. It had been crew in there. Crew. They would find the body. With arson and murder charges against him, the trust would disappear from his life. Worse, nobody would know for certain if the kid had survived. Charles Gunn's phone rang. He picked it up, was told by a young voice that there had just been a major explosion in Wilton. He input his code into a satellite access node on his laptop and chose the correct satellite, then zoomed until he had a clear shot of the town from above. There was smoke pouring out of a large building. He recognized three circular storage tanks, a grain elevator. He sat staring at it for some minutes. What might it mean? Was Mike in trouble, or was he succeeding? He was not reachable by phone, so there was no way to tell. At that moment, his six-year-old daughter came in.
"Mommy says to ask if you want coffee."
He drew his little girl close to him. As he nuzzled her flaxen hair, he punched numbers into his phone.
"Mr. President," he said, "the time is now."
"Is it?"
"Yes, sir." "We needed it some time ago."
"And it's going to be a purely localized thing?"
"Oh, absolutely, sir. Minimal damage."
"Thank you, Charles." The president hung up. Charles looked at the phone. What did this mean? He hadn't canceled the order, surely. No, he would have said something to that effect. Wouldn't he? His daughter asked,
"Was that the president?"
He kissed her.
"Mommy says you're very important. Are you very important?"
"What's important to me is being your daddy, Punkin."
He lifted her into his lap. She gazed into his eyes. She frowned.
"Are you upset, Daddy?"
He hugged his little girl. Mike Wilkes noted that firemen were not only chasing him now, they were making radio calls, and he could hear a higher-pitched siren than another. They were getting the police. He'd run out of options. He pulled the plane's remote out of his pocket and activated its GPS. He stopped long enough to input the code series that brought the plane to life. At each stage, he got a positive response. It was out there, thank God, and intact. Then the ETA came in. 4 minutes and 12 seconds before it could reach this location. Way too long, damn it. Lauren was fairly sure that she could sense Connor in her mind. What was amazing about this was that he was nowhere near this space. He couldn't be. She'd been able to perceive Adam's mind from no more than a few feet away. "I sense something," she said to Rob. "The boy is agitated.
He's seen the explosion."
"How do you feel him?"
"It's like remembering somebody in present tense, if that makes any sense."
"Is he in jeopardy?"
"I'm not sure. He seems agitated."
He called Crew's cell phone again, and again got his terse recorded message. Then he phoned Pete Simpson.
"We identified Wilkes's car. We located him in the town. I told Lewis immediately. The mountain says that Wilkes's car hasn't moved from behind the grain elevator."
Rob thanked Pete and hung up. He gazed out the window. On the horizon there was smoke.
"Look, I'm going to go into town.
I'm going with you.
Not with Mike at large. I need to get this situation into focus for me first. She let him go. Beyond the rail yard, Mike could see the center of Wilton. Cars came this way, and 20 or 30 people hurried up the broad street that crossed the rail yard and went past the elevator. At least 1 or 2 of them were bound to be among his human bombs, and they were walking right into the range of the signal that would trigger them, as indeed was the whole community. His bait was working efficiently. There was now little question in his mind but that the child would die. Outside, the crowd came closer to the burning structure. Nobody could see the antenna, let alone imagine that it was there, or how extraordinarily dangerous it was. The streams from the firemen's hoses made sleet, which slicked the ground. Sliding, Mike ran toward the crowd, picking out a woman who was hurrying along with her daughter.
"Hi there," he said as he trotted up to them.
Her eyes widened as she looked at him.
"He's hurt," the little girl said. "Oh my God, here, I've got my cell."
She began to rummage in her purse. A police car roared around the corner and came straight toward them across the rail yard. He grabbed her shoulder, drew his gun, and thrust it into her face. "Shut up," he yelled. "Don't move." He glared down at the little girl. "You move and your mommy gets her head blown open." The little girl began making a shrill, desolate noise. 2 minutes and 8 seconds before the TR would arrive. Getting aboard would be a near thing. He'd have to carry the kid.
"Take it easy," one of the 2 cops approaching him called. "Don't move an inch." "1 inch and she's fucking dead."
The woman gobbled in her throat. The cops froze. The little girl screamed at the cops, "Help my mommy!" They stayed like that, and a standoff was just what he needed. Finally, a warning warble came from the plane's remote. Mike was brushed with warm wash from its fans. There was no frost visible because the dehumidifiers would be working to remove every trace of moisture from that exhaust. With a swift and controlled motion, he reached around the mother and wove his fingers through the girl's hair. She howled and kicked and turned red as he dragged her. The remote was chiming 2 discordant notes. He thumbed the hatch control.
"Jesus Christ!" one of the cops yelled as the stair came down, apparently out of clear sky.
But then, of course, with the eye drawn to it, they could see the plane, a faint outline, its lines visible where the camouflage worked imperfectly. It wasn't designed to be invisible from this close, not if you were aware of its presence. Dragging the little girl by the hair, with her mother walking along, her hands out, begging, her eyes wild, full of tears, he backed up to the ladder. The child scrabbled at his hand in agony. An odor of urine rose from her twisting, struggling body. All in one motion, he dropped the girl and climbed into the ship. He jammed at the remote, but not fast enough. He had a cop on the damn ladder. The man was looking up at him, trying to bring his gun to bear. Mike fired directly into his face, which exploded like a smashed pumpkin when the jacketed magnum bullet blasted it. The body dropped away, and the ladder came up as Mike slid to the cockpit and dropped into the seat. He hammered buttons, preparing one of the 12 diversions the plane carried. It would eject in 10 seconds. The plane was not armored in any way, and that would do damage for certain. Immediately, he got an alarm on one of the 16 exhaust fans. As Mike took the ship up 200 feet at a sharp angle, the damaged fan shut down. The diversion ejected. This was an extremely bright plasma, which would draw the eye of everybody in the area. Gunfire erupted as the cops, deceived into believing that the glaring orb was the ship, shot into it. Resistant to the Earth's natural electrical charge, the coherent plasma shot off into the sky faster than a bullet.
"Holy God!" a voice yelled. "That was a goddamn UFO!"
Every eye was scanning the sky in the direction the diversion had gone. Mike turned the ship and moved off, quietly working his way out of town. 30. On the other side of the building, where the main fire deployment was underway, the firemen continued unrolling and charging hose. A burning grain elevator wasn't going to be extinguished. It was a matter of standing by, making certain it didn't spread,
and letting it burn itself out with as little damage to its surroundings as possible. So their main interest was the roof of Martin's feed store nearby, and the John Deere tractor dealership across the street, not the elevator, which was sending flames at this point well over 100 feet in the air.
"Captain, we gotta go in there," one of the firemen said.
"Don't do it, Harry, that's an order. You're gonna see the walls go any minute."
He grabbed his bullhorn.
"Okay, folks, back it up. Get those cars out of there."
Charles Gunn called the White House.
"Mr. President, I need that scalar pulse, sir. I don't understand why it hasn't gone in."
"I don't want to do it, Charles." Charles's heart quietly skipped a beat.
"Excuse me?"
"Charles, I'm not going to pull the trigger on Americans just on your say-so."
"It's not enough, Charles." It was as if he was talking to a different man.
"Mr. President, the whole future of mankind is riding on this."
"You didn't tell me the truth, Charles. I know the kind of damage this is going to cause, and I'm just not going to do it. How dare you lie to me like that?"
"Sir, I didn't."
"You lied, and you were willing to destroy the lives of millions and wreck the country. You're going to have to find another solution, Charles. This one's too expensive. And I have to tell you, I've got a problem, a major problem, Charles, with your even recommending such a course of action. You don't walk in here and do a thing like this, ask me to wreck my country and try to trick me into doing it."
Charles hung up the phone. He had to take a tremendous personal risk if he was going to cut false orders. There was plenty of precedent for it. Dean Bracewell had done it back during the Cold War when he'd moved elements of the Sixth Fleet from the Mediterranean to the Black Sea, in violation of détente in order to pull an asset out of Romania. The problem was, there was no real way to accomplish it without getting caught. Reagan had been furious at Bracewell, yelling at him, "The next time you try to start World War III, mention it to me first." Given the magnitude of what Charles was going to do, there would be more than a White House tantrum. At the least, he'd go to jail for life. Maybe he'd even suffer the death penalty. So he'd get Henry Vorona to do it. It would be easier for him anyway, given that he was active CIA. He'd tell Vorona that the president approved, but wanted the orders to flow this way. Problem solved. Driving toward town, Caitlin and Dan had fallen into another silence. Despite Connor's pleas, she was beginning to feel that Dan had just sort of slipped out of her soul. She should have found forgiveness for him, but she simply had not been able. Halfway to town, with the smoke now towering before them like a storm in the evening sky, Dan silently took her hand. She let him, but could not think why. In the Warner's car, Connor tried to keep the thoughts of others out of his head, but it was hard. He kept feeling like somebody else also. One moment he was himself, the next he seemed to have a huge complicated memory of things that had never happened to him, of flying in the stars, of being hideously lonely, of something that was terribly, terribly wrong. Except one thing was not wrong. He remembered Amy, who was sitting right beside him, as if he'd known her for 1,000 years. He remembered her in life and between lives, in the green rambles of death, planning this life together. He shuddered. How could he be thinking about things like this? He knew the secrets of the dead and the ages, knew them certainly. In a flash, he could see back huge distances in time, to bright, inexplicable fortresses and death serpents swarming ancient skies. And he could see the people around him, really see them. And it was wonderful and terrible. It was very terrible, because their secrets were as much a part of him as were his own. It was like spying on their souls, he decided, looking across the walls they had built around their soft, central needs.
"That is so awesome," Pauly said, looking at the rising smoke.
"Yeah," Connor agreed. It was an act, though. To appear to be himself as he had been, he had to pretend. His memories of last night were foggy, but he knew that something very incredible had happened.
"Dad, can you step on it, please?" Pauly asked. "We gotta watch the snow."
At least they weren't all full of hate. They were thinking about the grain elevator.
Mr. Warner was worried about not getting there in time for Polly to take pictures. Mrs. Warner was making plans to keep the boys from going too close. She was telling herself that she'd yell at them if she had to. In Polly's mind, there was nothing but smoke, fire, and eager excitement. Connor put his hands over his face and totally relaxed, blowing out a long breath. His bones seemed to tickle, and the feeling of the air on his skin changed. He had to learn to tune this stuff out. He'd messed up with Mom and Dad, shouting at them about their marriage secrets. He could hear their inner voices especially well, Dad's perfectly. He knew that this was because of Dad's implant, and he felt a question now. Somebody, was it called the Collective, was asking him if he wanted others implanted. They would implant anybody he wished, and he would be able to hear their thoughts perfectly, no matter where they were. He shook it off. It hadn't been a voice, but more thoughts entering his mind that were not his own, like smoke joining other smoke. He tuned into Dad by simply wanting to hear him. There came a tremendous burden of woe, a river of Mom's face and her skin, long streams of memories, such happy memories, of walking down Oak Road in the summertime, of moments in bed that he modestly turned away from, of a train trip they must have taken before he was born, and then this sad, sad thing that had happened with Marcy Cotton. And he saw why. The Greys had needed the family to stay here in Wilton, and they had made certain that Marcy would give Dad tenure. He saw the two of them whirling round and round in a dark place together, saw sparks of golden soul mingling, and understood what had happened. It made him angry at the Greys, because they had hurt Marcy and Mom and Dad just to get what they wanted. "You better understand that I'm calling my own shots now," he said in his mind. Instantly, there flashed before his eyes a vast wall of gray faces, eyes gleaming, arrayed in rows as far up and as far down as you could see. He cried out in surprise. "What's the matter?" Polly asked. "Scared?"
"Nah."
As Mr. Warner, stuck behind a truck, slammed his hands against the steering wheel, the color around him changed. The air flickered with red, and then took on darkness, especially around his head. He hammered on the horn and flashed his lights.
"John!"
Purple light filled the car, gushing off both Polly and Amy. Connor saw it coming out of himself, too, pulsing out of his chest with his heartbeat. He looked down at it and told it to go away, and as it did, so did the fear he had felt at Mr. Warner's outburst.
"Sorry. Sorry, folks. That guy was intentionally hassling me. Geez, it's Len Cavendish, too. He must have gone nuts. I hope he can still unstop sewers."
Connor watched the familiar Cavendish plumbing truck weave off down the road. Tim Cavendish had been in the passenger seat, and he had locked eyes with Connor, and Connor had heard a thought. Kill. Directed at him. He shook his head, trying to shake away the feeling of it, and the memory it had evoked of the awful time in the playground at recess. Since it was impossible to hear thoughts and see emotions, both of which he was doing, he decided that when he got home, he would go online and learn everything he could about schizophrenia. "If you're schizophrenic," he thought to himself, "you have to diagnose yourself and figure out a treatment protocol. If you need medical attention, you have to tell Mom and Dad." He would start at the New England Journal of Medicine and read all the recent monographs on childhood schizophrenia. Then he would go into the nutraceuticals literature. If there was a cure or a useful treatment, he would find it. As the sun dropped lower, the western sky turned dull orange behind the skeletons of trees. A car coming toward them suddenly sped up and smashed into the rear of the car in front of it. As they went on down the road, Connor could see the two drivers get out and start fighting like maniacs. There was a lot of black haze around the cars, the evil smoke of their rage. He had the strange, sickening feeling that it was somehow connected to him, as if the cars had been after him, on their way to Oak Road. That must be part of the schizophrenia, a paranoid aspect. There were drugs that controlled schizophrenia itself, but not paranoia. Paranoid schizophrenia was still difficult to manage. He had known for years that he might be susceptible to problems like this. He squirmed in his seat next to Polly. He did not want to see his beautiful mind destroyed. He watched purple fear gushing out of his chest like a waterfall and disappearing down through the floor of the car. He decided that he was definitely going around the bend. They got to the fire, and Paulie practically threw him across the street getting out of the car. He was tremendously excited, racing toward a cluster of their friends, waving his new camera and yelling. Connor noticed more of the black haze and saw that Will Heckle was as black as night. Was he coated with smoke or something? Connor was afraid of Will. That was not right that he would look like that. He stayed close to Paulie. "Awesome," Paulie breathed, looking up at the massive structure with flame shooting out of it. It was a marvelous fire, but Connor really did not like the way Will, and now Steve Stacy, and another of the older kids were looking at him. A lot of people sounded crazy, their thoughts roaring like a maddened troop of chimpanzees screaming at each other in the zoo. He began to look around for his parents, to cast for his dad's thoughts in the screaming turmoil around him. "Dad," he said in his mind. But of course Dad couldn't hear him. That was just the schizophrenia talking. Caitlin heard a cracking sound a good deal louder than the fire. Then she saw at the far end of the elevator that somebody was down, and a cop, young Tory Wright, was standing over him. "That looks like Dr. Bendener," she said. "It is Dr. Bendener. I wonder what in the world?" Tory Wright skull-whipped the old man with his nightstick, and Dr. Bendener's head flew from one side to the other with the blows. "My God, he's going to kill that old man," Caitlin yelled. She started to run toward them. The rest of the crowd totally ignored what was happening. Then two townies started fighting, and a fireman suddenly threw down his hose and stalked away, leaving it spraying like some mad snake, the brass head, a lethal projectile. "What is going on here, Dan?"
"We've got to get Connor."
He looked around, but it was hard to see through the icy haze being generated by the spraying hoses.
"Connor!"
Caitlin saw Marcy about 50 feet away. She froze, not knowing if she should go to her or what she should do. Marcy looked at her. A slight smile trembled in her face, vulnerable, ashamed. She took a step forward. Caitlin did the same.
"Caitlin, forgive me. I don't know what happened. I can't explain it, and I'm deeply ashamed, Caitlin."
As the fire roared and the water thundered, the two women embraced.
"Something happened, Marcy," Caitlin said.
Sleet swept over them.
"I know it. I had... Oh, Caitlin, what's going on? Something is not right."
Without warning, the hose the firemen had abandoned seemed to rear up before them like a cobra. Caitlin leaped away, but it smashed into Marcy's face and slammed her to the ground.
"My God, it hit her! Help her!" she screamed at the firemen. "Help her!"
Dan saw she was badly hurt and ran to her, and found her jaw shattered, and blood bubbling out of her mouth, and her eyes filmed and uncomprehending.
"Marcy," he cried, going down to her. "Help me, this woman is dying. She's dying."
Caitlin saw firemen staring, but not at Marcy. He looked off into the crowd, into the blowing ice haze. She looked around again for Connor, still did not see him. She ran to Dan.
"Dan, we've got to help her."
But Dan heard something. He heard it in his left ear, as clearly as if a radio had been turned on there. It was Connor's voice.
"Dad, I need you."
The implant, he realized that it was there for Connor, to help Connor. He went to his feet.
"She's beyond help, Caitlin. Connor is calling us. I can hear him. It's the implant, Caitlin. We've got to find him."